This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and in today's program, an analysis of President Barack Obama's assault on Social Security benefits. This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and in today's program, we take a close look at the remarkable proposal of President Barack Obama made on the 10th of April of this year to use the chained price index, the so-called CPI, as a means of reducing the deficit and government expenditures, and thereby effectively financially vandalizing the stable, secure Social Security program into which so many people have paid so much. The issue of Social Security has always been what is called a third rail issue, one that is of great concern to a great majority of people of poverty and elderly Americans.
Social Security is totally funded by the payroll tax levied on employer and employee.
Now's the time to protect Social Security for future generations.
In 2008, he said that he would not cut Social Security. We want the president to remember what he said and not go back on his word.
And there you had two presidents and a leader, President Ronald Reagan, Senator Bernie Sanders, and President Barack Obama, with a promise that has gone by the wayside with his April 10th proposal unilaterally to cut Social Security expenditures with a so-called chained price index. That means that the less money people are paying on essentials is counted as a benefit, a reduction of their expenses, and that Social Security payments would be lowered accordingly. How do we understand more fully this concept of the CPI, the chained price index? Well, let's ask a labor secretary in the person of Robert Reich.
The White House and prominent Democrats are talking about reducing future Social Security payments by using a formula for adjusting for inflation that's stingier than the current one. That formula is called the chained CPI. The idea is that when prices go up, most people substitute lower cost items. So a true calculation of the cost of living should take account of this substitution effect. This makes no sense for seniors because they spend 20 to 40% of their incomes on healthcare, and they can't substitute lower cost alternatives. The cost of healthcare has been rising faster than inflation. Not even Social Security's current inflation adjustment adequately accounts for it. Social Security benefits are already meager for most recipients. The median income of Americans over 65 is less than $20,000 a year. Nearly 70% of them depend on Social Security for more than half of this. The average Social Security benefit is less than $15,000 a year. Besides, Social Security isn't in serious trouble. The Social Security Trust Fund is flush for at least two decades. If we want to ensure it's there beyond that, there's an easy fix. Just lift the ceiling on income subject to Social Security taxes, which is now $113,700. Why are Democrats even suggesting the inflation adjustment be reduced? Republicans aren't asking for it. Not even Paul Ryan's draconian budget includes it. Democrats invented Social Security and have been protecting it for almost 80 years. They shouldn't be leading the charge against it. Call your member of Congress and tell them no chained CPI. Hands off Social Security.
Former Labor Secretary Robert Reich, now with MoveOn.org, speaking about the Obama proposal for a CPI, a chained price index for Social Security. This is 5 o'clock shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we're now joined live from Washington, D.C. by Dan Adcock. He is the Director of Governmental Relations at the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. He's also a Master's of Political Science from American University. And welcome to the show, Dan.
Thanks, Robert.
The issue is the CPI, the price index that, oddly, President Obama proposed on the 10th of April, 2013. And did you ever envision a day that you would see a Democratic Party president unilaterally offering to cut back on Social Security, a Democratic program that came through the days of Roosevelt?
I really didn't, and it's in stark contrast to a couple things that happened just within the last 6 months. You look at the president's inaugural address where he really said some moving things about Social Security, about the importance of protecting it, that it wasn't a handout, that it's something that was something that, that people earned through paying payroll taxes for a career. And he also said it in a meeting with leaders of my organization, the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, and other organizations that care about Social Security, back in November, that he wasn't going to suggest that Social Security benefits be cut. So, yes, didn't think we'd ever see this, and are really disappointed that the one Social Security proposal in the president's budget is a proposal to cut benefits.
Whether this was Obama trying to be too smart by half or not, immediately there was a reply from the Republican leader, Mr. Boehner, saying, well, that's cool, that's great. Since you're admitting that it has nothing to do with the deficit, we accept this as a standalone proposal, quite apart from the budget deliberations. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that kind of response can be expected. And it's interesting. I was at a hearing this morning of the House Subcommittee on Social Security. Sam Johnson, congressman from Texas, is the chair of that committee. And in his parting shot to Congressman Xavier Becerra from California, who's the ranking member of that committee, he said to him at the end of the hearing by saying, "Your president likes this idea." Unfortunately, that's the baggage now that we have to deal with. I'd like to think, based on many things that the president has said and many things that the president's staff has said since the budget proposal has come out, that short of a very large deal, like a $1.8 trillion deal, to deal with the sequester as well as increasing the national debt limit, that this proposal won't see the light of day. But, the president now, he broke it, and now he owns it. And so it's unfortunate, something that's going to be associated with him for a long time to come.
Can you help our listeners understand the meaning of this proposal, the CPI, in regard to Social Security? Now, we heard Robert Reich explaining it, and I may not completely understand it myself. I imagine it in these terms. Suppose an elder had been eating roast beef, but then because of other exigencies and requirements of survival, started eating bologna and then cat food. Now, if I understand this correctly, that means that the government under this Obama proposal would then be saying, well, look at how much money you've saved by not buying roast beef or even bologna. So we're going to deduct from you according to that boon, that benefit, that cat food benefit that you have gotten. Is that roughly how it works?
It is. I mean, the problem with the chain CPI is that, what its supporters, how they promote it, is they suggest that it does a better job of measuring the substitution effect. But the problem with it is that it's a substitution effect that never ends. It's not too far from the truth the way you described it. It's a race to the bottom. It's you're constantly substituting for the next least expensive product. And when it comes to the 40 million, or rather the 56 million seniors and disabled Americans that participate in the Social Security program, they rely on health care for a disproportionate share of their income. They're spending about 20-40% out of pocket on health care. And, there's no way that when a doctor prescribes a colonoscopy that you can substitute that for a cheaper colonoscopy. The substitution effect certainly doesn't work with things like health care, where you have to either pay what a negotiated rate is through Medicare or your insurance company, or you're just not going to get the service. And so that's the most important part of it. Not the other part of it also is that all cost of living adjustments really are supposed to do is help maintain people's quality of life. They're a hedge against inflation. But you do something like this, where you undermine that inflation protection, and people are not going to be able to maintain their quality of life, And, you know, it, the substitution for things like food and gasoline and, you know, those are bad enough. But certainly when it gets even worse when we're talking about substitution for different types of health care, which just is unacceptable.
We're speaking with Dan Adcock, the Director of Government Relations and Policy of the National Commission to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. And Dan, are there demographic studies that indicate who needs Social Security and the differentials among different classes of recipients?
Yeah, there certainly is. Right now, the bottom 40% of the income scale depend who are Social Security beneficiaries depend on Social Security for nearly 90% of their benefits. So, you know, when you do something like this, those particular people in that particular group are going to take a disproportionate hit. The sinister thing about the chain CPI is that the amount of money that you lose as a Social Security beneficiary grows like a snowball rolling down a hill. So every year, you know, in the first year, the average beneficiary is going to lose about $130 a year. But by the time they turn 95, they're going to be losing $1,400 a year. So you talk about these people that are depending on Social Security for almost all of their income in retirement, and you chip away at this, and not only are you chip, you know, not only is it a hit, but it's a hit that grows every year. You do really force people into these positions where they have to choose between, you know, between regular food and cat food, and it's made even much more, you know, much more acute by the fact, that millions of people reach retirement age with little private savings. That half of all workers in the United States have no access to retirement plans at work. And so as employer-sponsored retirement and health benefits have declined, the only thing left for most Americans is Social Security and Medicare. And if you're going to cut those particular benefits, then you're really risking a tsunami of older people living in retirement.
Speaking of older people, we're also hearing talk of proposals coming forward for recession of the age of eligibility for Social Security from 65 to 67. Is there any truth to that prospect, and what would that mean?
Well, at this point, unfortunately, you know, to the president's credit, that is not something that he's suggested, and I doubt that he will. But, you know, these are proposals that are certainly on the table, that could be considered as part of a budget process. And, you know, I think the way to think about all this is that, you know, right now we're talking about this year's budget. And on the table is, you know, the president's chain CPI proposal, as well as some proposals that he has that would shift costs to Medicare beneficiaries. So obviously those are bad enough in and of themselves. And let's say hypothetically that he and the Congress agreed to a so-called grand bargain deal. And so I think that there may be some wishful thinking going on out there that would be the end, and that you wouldn't see any further proposals to reduce Social Security and Medicare. But the truth of the matter is that anytime we have to pass an increase in the debt limit or pass a continuing resolution bill to make sure the government continues to operate, or to try to avoid one of these fiscal cliffs or a sequester, that gives leverage to lawmakers who want to make cuts to these programs to extract the kind of cuts that you mentioned, like raising the Social Security retirement age or the Medicare eligibility age. And the really awful part of those proposals is that all of us are living longer. That's true, but that is an average, and there's a lot of people that are not going to live to see those benefits if they're not going to receive a dime off of those benefits if they don't make it to the new retirement age or make it to the new Medicare eligibility age.
One other thing, Dan Adcock, the Social Security system, as I understand it, is solvent and well already paid for through the contributions of workers to what they once believed might be their surety or security in an advanced age. And I understand that over the years it has been sort of like a honeypot for government borrowing, and that now that the government is in debt and comes time to repay this, that they're trying to take it off the back end of the elderly. Can you speak to the stability of the Social Security system and why we are even discussing raiding it in this way?
Sure. Well, I guess there's kind of two different things going on there. One is, are these proposals to specifically cut benefits? And they do two. When you do that, it serves two purposes. One, it does extend the solvency of the Social Security Trust Fund, but at the same time, it also helps to reduce federal spending, even though Social Security has not contributed a dime to either the deficit or debt. With regard to the Social Security Trust Fund and its place in the United States government's budget, the way it works is that we all pay, as long as we're earning wages, we pay Social Security payroll taxes into the fund. And when that cash from our paychecks goes into the funds, it is converted into U.S. Treasury securities which are backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government. When it's time to pay out those benefits, what happens is that revenues coming into the government coffers from payroll taxes is used to pay for Social Security benefits, but to some extent, those Treasury securities and the Social Security Trust Fund are being redeemed to pay benefits. But in any year you're running a surplus in the Social Security Trust Fund, those government securities are accumulating. So at a time when we're not running in a surplus, we'll be able to pay Social Security benefits, and we're going to be able to pay 100% of Social Security benefits according to the Social Security trustees until 2033, and after that point we'll be able to pay 75% of Social Security benefits if Congress fails to act between now and then. But I really believe that won't happen, that one way or another the Congress will come to some sort of agreement, just as they did in 1982 between Tip O'Neill and President Reagan, to come to an agreement on a long-term solution. And one of the things we would like to see, as your intro piece showed that Secretary Reich said, is to raise the cap on Social Security payroll taxes so that all Americans pay 6.2% of their income, of their wage income, to help support what has been one of the most successful programs in the history of the United States government.
Well, I thank you so much for the insight, Dan Adcock, of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. How can people keep up to date with your work and support the institution?
Well, what they can do is they can visit our website, which is at www.ncpssm.org. That's www.ncpssm.org, or they can call our toll-free number at 800-966-1935. That's 800-966-1935.
Well, thank you, Dan Adcock, Director of Government Relations and Policy of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacific Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York.
Well, I am delighted to be here with my friends in the Progressive Caucus and Senator Harkin. And we're also standing with groups like the AFL-CIO and Rich Trumker and millions of workers. We're standing with the AARP and the National Committee to Defend Social Security and millions of seniors. We're standing here today with every veterans organization in this country, and we're standing here with the National Organization for Women. What we are here doing is not just us. We are representing tens of millions of Americans who are saying that at a time when we have more wealth and income inequality in this country than at any time since the 1920s, you do not balance the budget on the on the backs of the elderly, the children, the sick, and the poor.
That's right.
As Senator Harkin indicated, when one out of four major corporations, profitable corporations, is paying zero in taxes, when we're losing $100 billion every year because corporations are stashing their money in the Cayman Islands and in some cases paying nothing in taxes, there are ways to do deficit reduction that are fair. But let me add to something. I stand here today not only as someone in opposition to cuts in Social Security, but as chairman of the Veterans Senate Committee. And I don't know what kind of country we become when we think that we are going to balance the budget on the backs of men and women who have lost their arms, their legs, and their eyesight defending this country. So we stand united in saying we are not going to balance this budget on the backs of disabled veterans. And don't kid yourself, those cuts in the chain CPI will be very significant, will be very hurtful to people who have already given so much to our country. Thank you.
And let me tell you, today before you, Senator Sanders is absolutely right. Men and women all over this country are being represented at this podium today. And one of the champions of labor, Rich Crumka, is here with us today at the AFL-CIO. Come on up here, Mr. Crumka.
Thank you. First of all, let me say good afternoon. Let me thank everybody for coming. I'm pleased to be in such great company. And I want to thank all the great representatives here for standing up for the seniors, for the disabled, and all of those that depend on Social Security. And let me start with one fundamental truth. Social Security did not cause, nor did it add to, the deficit in any way, right? So we've come here to express our collective opposition to a bad policy proposal, the chain CPI. Chain CPI is some economist's fancy way of weakening one of Social Security's most important protections, namely its cost of living increases, its annual COLA. That protects the purchasing power of benefits from inflation. To put it simply, Social Security's COLA protects the real value of benefits, and it prevents seniors from losing economic ground each and every year. Now, for seniors, this COLA is particularly critical because other sources of income decline with age. Although the average annual benefit is just $15,000, it comprises 90% of the income of one-third of the seniors and disabled. Now, only 14% of our citizens have a defined benefit plan. And the median level of the 401ks in this country is $16,649. That means half of America has a 401k of $16,649 or less. Now, does anybody really believe that we have too much retirement security in this country? No. Does anybody believe that our seniors are well enough off and should be the ones to give more up at a time when it's obvious to all that U.S. corporations are not paying their fair share? Does anybody believe that this is the time to make economic inequality worse? Does anyone here really believe that our private pension system is flourishing, or that American workers can amass secure retirement savings accounts that can be counted on to last a lifetime? And who here believes that Americans can rely on the equity in their homes for financial security?
What equity?
You know, now I've been told that not to worry about the chain CPI because there will be protections for some of the most vulnerable in our society, that our oldest seniors will receive a one-time benefit bump to lessen the hurt of the benefit cut. You know, if the chain CPI is more accurate and a more accurate measure, why the exemptions? Why having that? See, I know something about bargaining. And even when you comprise or you compromise, you don't give up a fundamental value. And Social Security represents the best of American values, and more importantly, it works. So we call on the President and members of Congress to use our collective energy to protect and enhance, rather than diminish, one of the nation's finest, most popular family protections and one program that helps the disabled more than any other. Thanks for being here.
Go, Richard!
Way to go, man.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and that was a recent rally convened by the Congressional Progressive Caucus and labor leaders on the issue of the Obama proposal to cut spending for Social Security. That issue, along with the background of the takeaway from government funds for the various wars of choice, and the diminishment of the benefits for American military veterans, as well as the effect on the elderly of the Obama proposal for Social Security, was taken up in the halls of Congress in the Senate by Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders.
Mr. President, everybody knows that our country has an $850 billion deficit and a $16-plus trillion national debt. But what has not been discussed as often as it should is how we came into that financial position. How do we have the deficit, and how do we have this huge debt? Let us not forget, as we discuss this issue, that in January of 2001, when President Bill Clinton left office, this country had an annual federal budget surplus of $236 billion. Surplus of $236 billion in January 2001. We now have an $850 billion deficit. What happened? Well, I think many Americans know what happened. When you go to war in Afghanistan and Iraq and you don't pay for those wars, you add to the deficit. When you give huge tax breaks to the wealthiest people in this country and you don't offset that, you add to the deficit. When you pass a Medicare Part D prescription drug program, you don't pay for that, you add to the deficit. And on top of all of that, we must understand that right now, at 15.8% of GDP, revenue coming into the federal government is the lowest that it has been in 60 years. And the reason for that is that we are in the midst of a very serious recession, a recession caused by the greed, recklessness, and illegal behavior on Wall Street. And not only has that led to significant increases in unemployment and businesses going under, once again, it resulted in less tax revenue coming in to this government. And by the way, Mr. President, when we talk about Wall Street and the greed and the recklessness and illegal behavior on Wall Street, I must say that I was really stunned when the Attorney General of the United States recently suggested that it might be difficult to prosecute Wall Street CEOs who commit crimes because of the destabilizing effect that prosecution might have on the financial system of our country and the world. In other words, we have a situation now where Wall Street is not only too big to fail, they are too big to jail. And the theory is that if you're just a regular person, you commit a crime, you go to jail. You're head of a Wall Street company. Your power is so great, the tentacles of that company are so great, that if you are prosecuted and there's destabilization in that company, it can have worldwide or national implications. Mr. President, that is an issue we have got to think long and hard about. We are supposed to be a country of law, and that law should apply to the CEOs of Wall Street companies as well as everybody else. Mr. President, the other point I want to make deals, if you want, with a moral issue. When you're dealing with deficit reduction, I've just described how we got into the deficit situation. But when you're dealing with the deficit situation and you say we need to make sacrifices, it is absolutely appropriate and ask who is best able to make those sacrifices. And right now, as I think most Americans know, the wealthiest people in this country are doing phenomenally well. Large corporations are enjoying record-breaking profits. That's one group of people. Meanwhile, the middle class of this country is disappearing, and we have 46 million people living in poverty. So common morality, basic morality, says, who do you ask most significantly to help us with deficit reduction? Do you tell an unemployed worker who is struggling to keep his or her family afloat that we're going to balance the budget on your back? Or do you say maybe to a huge profitable corporation that in some cases is paying nothing in taxes, that, you know what, we're going to ask you to help us with deficit reduction. Now, Mr. President, it is important for us to do what we do too rarely on the floor of the Senate, take a hard look at what's happening to the American people right now. I am very pleased we're seeing more job creation. Good thing. We're seeing somewhat of a recovery in housing. Very good thing. But let us understand where the middle class of this country is today, where the working class of this country is today, before we demand that we balance the budget on their backs, as the Ryan budget in the House does. Mr. President, since 1999, the average middle-class family has seen its income go down by nearly $5,000 after adjusting for inflation. Median family income today is lower than it was in 1996. Real unemployment is not 7.7%. It is 14.3% if you count those people who have given up looking for work and are working part-time. Youth unemployment is even higher. More than 25% of young Americans are unemployed. In terms of the African-American community, unemployment is off the charts. Mr. President, when we talk about job creation, we all want job creation. It is important, however, to understand that nearly 60% of the new jobs that have been created since 2010 are low-wage jobs, paying between $7.80 an hour and $13.80 an hour. Jobs, yes, but we want jobs that families can take care of their families on, not just low-wage jobs. Further, Mr. President, when we are talking about the budget, and we don't talk about this at all, I know that my Republican friends don't talk about it, most of my Democratic friends don't talk about it. It's anathema here to talk about issues of distribution of wealth and income, but I think it is important before we talk about on whose backs we're going to balance the budget. Today, the United States has the most unequal distribution of wealth and income of any major country on earth, and the gap between the very, very wealthy and everyone else is growing wider and wider. Incredibly, the wealthiest 400 individuals in this country today own more wealth than the bottom half of America, 150 million people. Now, Mr. President, I think that's an issue we might want to discuss, even if it offends some of our wealthy campaign contributors. But I think we should put that on the table. Today, one family, the Walton family of Walmart, owns more wealth than the bottom 40% of families in this country. And by the way, you'll all be delighted to know they got a huge tax break recently. Today, the top 1% owns 38% of all financial wealth. That is a stunning number. What is even more stunning is the bottom 60% own 2.3% of the wealth in this nation. 1% on top owns 38% of the wealth, bottom 60% owns 2.3%. And who does Mr. Ryan and my Republican friends want to balance the budget on? Those 60%, the working families who already have nothing, who are losing what they have, who are struggling to keep their heads above water. But it's not just distribution of wealth. It's distribution of income. If you can believe it, this is just, again, a stunning fact, which for some reason we don't talk about too much here on the floor. A recent study showed that all of the new income gained from 2009 to 2011 went to the top 1%. 99% gained nothing. So who do we balance the budget on? Well, of course, you go after the middle class, go after the working class, go after low-income people. Well, maybe, somebody might want to ask that 1% to start paying a little bit more in taxes before we cut Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, education, and nutrition. Mr. President, one of the good parts of the Murray budget is that it provides $100 billion in funding to put millions of Americans back to work, rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure. I would have gone much higher, because while deficit reduction is a very serious issue, it is even more important that we start putting millions of people back to work who are in desperate need of employment. Fastest way to do that is to rebuild our crumbling infrastructure. $100 billion is a good start. We need more. Now, Mr. President, during the consideration of the budget resolution, I plan on offering two amendments. The first amendment, number 264, would create a reserve fund to reduce the deficit and create jobs by eliminating offshore tax abuse by large, profitable corporations. The second amendment, amendment number 198, would establish a deficit-neutral reserve fund to protect the benefits of disabled veterans, and I speak as chairman of the Veterans Committee, disabled vets and their survivors, by not enacting the so-called chain CPI, and I'm pleased that this amendment is being co-sponsored by Senator Harkin and Senator Hirono. And let me take a few minutes to describe both of these amendments. Mr. President, at a time when corporate profits are at an all-time high, when the effective corporate tax rate is at a 40-year low, when one out of four profitable corporations pay zero in taxes, it is time for large, profitable corporations to significantly contribute to deficit reduction. Now, the first amendment that I'll be offering would create a reserve fund to reduce the deficit and create jobs by eliminating offshore tax abuse by large, profitable corporations. Mr. President, in 2011, corporate revenue as a percentage of GDP was just 1.2%. That is lower than any other major country in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, lower than Britain, Germany, France, Japan, Canada, you name it. Each and every year, corporations and the wealthy are avoiding more than $100 billion in U.S. taxes by sheltering their income offshore. Offshore tax schemes have become so absurd that one five-story building in the Cayman Islands is now the quote-unquote home to more than 18,000 corporations. Mr. President, when the Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Citigroup needed a taxpayer bailout in 2008, and I did not vote for that bailout, they told us what great Americans they were, how much they loved the United States of America, proud to be an American. But when it comes to paying their taxes, these large Wall Street companies are proud to be with the Cayman Islands. So my suggestion to these corporations, next time you need a bailout, don't come to the taxpayers of America. Go to the people of the Cayman Islands and get your bailout there. But so long as you're an American company, how about helping us with deficit reduction and paying some taxes in this country? But it's not just Wall Street. You got pharmaceutical companies like Eli Lilly and Pfizer also using offshore tax havens. Apple wants all the advantages of being an American company, but it doesn't want to pay American taxes or American wages. It creates the iPad, the iPhone, the iPod, iTunes in the United States, manufactures most of its products in China, and then it ships most of its profits to Ireland, Luxembourg, the British Virgin Islands, and other tax havens to avoid paying U.S. taxes. Mr. President, this is a huge issue. By the way, it's not just an American issue. It is an issue facing governments all over the world. Corporations run to tax havens, Cayman Islands, Bermuda, and elsewhere. We have got to address that issue. Mr. President, I'm going to list for the record, submit to the record, 15 large, profitable corporations that have used offshore tax havens to avoid paying U.S. income taxes in recent years. Top of the list, I'm going to give you just one example. Bank of America. 2010, Bank of America set up more than 200 subsidiaries in the Cayman Islands to avoid paying U.S. taxes. It worked. Not only did Bank of America pay nothing in federal income taxes, but it received a rebate from the IRS for $1.9 billion that year. Now, before you cut Social Security and Medicaid and Medicare, do you think maybe we might want to ask Bank of America, who we bailed out, by the way, to help us with deficit reduction? General Electric, during the last 5 years, General Electric made $81 billion in profits. Not only has General Electric avoided paying federal income taxes during these years, it received a tax rebate of $3 billion from the IRS. GE has at least 14 offshore subsidiaries in Bermuda, Singapore, and Luxembourg. Citigroup, Verizon, Honeywell International, J.P. Morgan Chase, Merck, Corning, Boeing, Goldman Sachs, Microsoft, Caterpillar, Cisco Systems, Dow Chemicals, major profitable corporations using tax havens to avoid paying in the United States of America. We have an amendment to deal with that issue, and I hope we can have bipartisan support for that amendment. Now, Mr. President, I want to talk about my Second Amendment, and now I speak as chairman of the Veterans Committee. This amendment, number 198, would establish a deficit neutral reserve fund to protect the benefits of disabled veterans and their survivors by not enacting the so-called chain CPI. And I'm pleased that this amendment is being co-sponsored by Senators Harkin and Hirono. Mr. President, the time has come for the Senate to send a very loud and clear message to the American people. We will not balance the budget on the backs of disabled veterans who have lost their arms, their legs, and their eyesight defending our country. We will not balance the budget on the backs of the men and women who have already sacrificed for us in Iraq and Afghanistan, nor on the widows who have lost their husbands in Iraq and Afghanistan defending our country. And we will not balance the budget on the backs of those who served so valiantly in World War II, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, the Gulf War, and other conflicts by cutting Social Security benefits. We will not adopt the chained CPI. Mr. President, Madam President, the chained CPI is forcefully opposed by every major veterans organization in this country. And I've talked to many of them, and they are outraged that after the sacrifices veterans have made, that people want to balance the budget on their backs. And all of the veterans organizations are in opposition to the chain CPI, and it includes, of course, the American Legion, the VFW, the Disabled American Veterans, the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, Gold Star Wives, DAV, you name the veterans organizations, and they are in opposition. But it's not just the veterans organizations who opposed the chain CPI. Chain CPI is opposed by every major senior citizen group in this country, including the AARP, the largest senior group. And I understand they've been calling up members of the Senate and the House, and I hope members will listen to what the AARP has to say, the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, and the Alliance for Retired Americans. The chain CPI is opposed by every major union in this country. And I had a press conference not so long ago with Rich Trumka of the AFL-CIO. They are strongly opposed to this chain CPI. The chain CPI is opposed by every major disability group in this country. It is opposed by the National Organization for Women, because they understand what the chain CPI would mean for women. Madam President, there are some who believe that lowering cost of living adjustments, COLAs, through the adoption of a chain CPI would be just a minor tweak in benefits. But let's be clear. For millions of disabled veterans and seniors living on fixed incomes, the chain CPI is not a minor tweak. It is a significant benefit cut that will make it harder for permanently disabled veterans and the elderly to feed their families, heat their homes, pay for their prescription drugs, and make ends meet. This misguided proposal must be vigorously opposed. You know, in one moment or another, everybody here is talking about how they want to save Social Security, because they know back home that Social Security is enormously popular. Poll after poll, whether you're Democrat, Republican, Independent, what people are saying is don't cut Social Security. Don't cut benefits for disabled veterans. Well, now we're going to give members on both sides of the aisle the opportunity to act on what they have been saying for many, many years. Now, supporters of the chain CPI want the American people to believe that the COLAs that disabled vets, senior citizens, and the surviving spouses and children who have lost loved ones in combat, they're too generous. So any senior citizen who is listening to this, The theory behind the chain CPI is the benefits that you have been getting is too generous. And whenever I say this in Vermont, people start laughing. They really do. And I have to say, no, they're not kidding. They're really serious. Now, at a time when some think these benefits are too serious, we should understand that in 2 out of the last 4 years, disabled vets and senior citizens did not receive any COLA at all. Zero. So I guess a zero COLA is too generous. Too generous. And this year's COLA of 1.7% is one of the lowest ever at a time when prescription drug costs for seniors going up, healthcare costs for seniors going up, heating costs in cold weather states like mine going up, food costs going up, and yet seniors got a 1.7% COLA, and there are people who say, oh, that's much too generous. Madam President, today more than 3.2 million disabled vets received disability compensation benefits from the VA and would be negatively impacted by the chain CPI. Are you really ready? After all of the great speeches we hear, the speeches of thank you to the veterans who put their lives on the line, who gave their lives defending this country, you really want to cut benefits to those people who lost their arms and their legs, their eyesight? I hope not. Mr. President, Madam President, under the chain CPI, a disabled veteran who started receiving VA disability benefits at age 30 would have their benefits cut by more than $1,400 at age 45, $2,300 at age 55, and $3,200 at age 65. Now, for our Wall Street friends, the people who make millions of dollars a year, that's not a lot of money. But for people who are trying to survive on $20,000, $25,000, $15,000 a year, that is a big hit. And in my view, if you respect veterans and the sacrifices they have made, if you respect the greatest generation and what they have done to make this country great, you don't balance the budget on their backs. Let me just conclude by saying that I have been to Walter Reed and I have seen what war has done to veterans, and many of my colleagues have done the same. In Vermont, we paid a very, very heavy price in the Iraq War, and I've been to too many funerals, and I know many of my colleagues have done the same. And I just ask, Madam President, that before we support this so-called chain CPI, which will make devastating cuts on the backs of disabled veterans and senior citizens, we remember the sacrifices that those people made. And, Madam President, what I would like is to ask unanimous consent to enter into the record statements from the American Legion in opposition to the chain CPI, and what Jim Coutts, who is the national commander of the American Legion, says, and he says, and I quote, on behalf of the 2.4 million members of the American Legion, I voice our opposition to the chain CPI because of the harmful effects it will have on veterans. And he goes on in greater detail. I also want to enter into the record a letter that I received from the executive director of the Disabled American Veterans, Barry Jasinowski. And he writes, and I quote, on behalf of all disabled veterans and their families, we stand with you in firm opposition to the application of the chain CPI to disability and pension payments for veterans, dependents, and survivors of veterans. And I would like to enter that full that letter into the record.
Without objection.
And Madam President, I also ask unanimous consent to enter into the record letters I received from the veterans of foreign wars, the Paralyzed Veterans of America, the Blinded Veterans Association, the Gold Star Wives, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, Vietnam Veterans of America, and several other veterans groups who, in one letter, they came together to write me a letter, and this is what they said. As efforts to address, and I quote, as efforts to address our nation's debt continue, we are writing to express our opposition to changing the formula used to calculate the annual cost of living adjustments because of the harmful effects it will have on veterans and Social Security benefits. We agree that political leaders need to restore fiscal discipline, but we believe it should be done with great care and without reneging on this country's promise to veterans, including the promises of Social Security and VA disability compensation and pension benefits, all of which are modest in size. And that's a letter that comes to me from the VFW, the Paralyzed Veterans of America, Blinded Veterans Association, Gold Star Wives, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, and Vietnam Veterans of America. And without, I would ask unanimous consent to submit that letter to the record.
Without objection.
So here we are, Madam President. We're in the deficit situation because of wars that were unpaid for, tax breaks for the wealthiest people in this country, Medicare Part D not paid for, and a recession caused by Wall Street. And now we have folks who are saying, well, yeah, we got a serious deficit problem, and I agree. And the way we're going to do it is make devastating cuts on the backs of some of the most vulnerable people in this country, including disabled vets and including people who receive Social Security and disability benefits. I don't think that's the moral thing to do. I don't think that's the economically appropriate thing to do. When you have one out of four major corporations, huge corporations, profitable corporations paying zero in taxes, when the corporate tax rate today, the effective corporate tax rate, is the lowest that it has been in decades, when the gap between the very, very wealthy and everybody else is growing wider. Madam President, there are ways to do deficit reduction that are fair. And I will do everything that I can to make sure that as we go forward with deficit reduction, we do it in a way that is fair and not on the backs of some of the most vulnerable people in this country. With that, Madam President, I would yield the floor.
And that concludes today's 5 o'clock shadow. The program was engineered by Michael G. Haskins, Reggie Johnson, and Sean Rhodes. We welcome your comments, questions, leaks, and suggestions with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 o'clock shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.